At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the final countdown to what some fear may not be a final countdown tonight. As Texans go to the polls, the latest and what to watch for coming up on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown with a presidential race that appears to be more competitive in Texas than it has been for decades, and 8 million voters having already cast a ballot in the Lone Star State, and more in line as we speak. Karen Tumulty of the Washington Post and Evan Smith of the Texas Tribune join us live to talk about the issues on this election day. Also, a closer look at how the vote counting process will play out across Texas. Professor Stephen Vladek with the legal issues at play. And a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway on this election day, right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this election day 2020. I'm David Brown, and it's great to have you with us. Just 3 hours or so ago, the polls officially opened on this last day of one of the most unusual and momentous election seasons in the history of Texas and across the country. There were reports of Americans lining up at dawn to cast their ballots in a nation that seems united on at least this much, a feeling of uncertainty and anxiety about what comes next. Much of that anxiety has been driven by fear, not just of conditions like the ongoing pandemic, unemployment, and the precarious state of the economy, but fear that one side or the other will reject the outcome of the final tally tonight, taking the nation into a place we have not been before. By all accounts, it's been a long time since Texas has been at a political crossroads like this one. Not since a certain Georgia peanut farmer ran for the White House has a majority of Texans voted to elect a president with a big D beside his name. And it's been over a decade since the Texas House had a Democratic majority. That too could change once the vote count is concluded. And there are other signs that what the nation has for many years regarded as the reddest of red states could alter its political hue. But the greatest anxiety is over what happens once the election stations close. With news organizations like this one vowing not to make any early predictions of winners, and with the prospect of at least one race being called early by the candidate himself, you may know the one, there are almost certain to be claims and counterclaims based on half-facts, rumors, and speculation rampant on social media and more. Amid the noise, what should we ignore and what should we watch for? For some insight, we are joined on this election day by Evan Smith, CEO and co-founder of the Texas Tribune. Evan, welcome back to The Standard.
Thanks, David.
And we are also joined by Karen Tumulty. She is a veteran political journalist, a San Antonio native, and current political columnist for The Washington Post. Karen, thanks for being here.
Great to be here.
Evan, let's begin with you. You've been covering Texas politics for years. The word unprecedented has been overused, I think, during this election cycle. And it all kind of boils down to this when we're talking about the national political scene. Can Joe Biden actually win Texas?
He can. I can't believe I'm saying it. I'm always the last guy airlifted off the roof of the embassy at the end of the war on the subject of whether Democrats are going to win back the presidential at the presidential level in Texas. It's been a very long time, as you know. 1976 was the last time a Democrat won the state. Do I think Joe Biden has a great chance of winning? No. Do I think Joe Biden has a reasonable chance of winning? Yes. Would it be the most surprising thing in the world if it happened? No. Shocking, yes. Surprising, no.
Karen, what's the view from D.C. when it comes to Texas and its role? You know, 38 electoral votes there, and a win for Biden in Texas would be quite an obstacle for a Republican to get back into the White House.
And, you know, I am, you know, up here, a rare Texan in this in the liberal sea of Washington, D.C., and so I am always the skeptic in the room. I mean, there have been so many cycles where, you know, outside political consultants have raised a lot of money convincing people that Texas is in play when it isn't. So I'm still skeptical. I could potentially see, you know, if Texas flips, we are talking about, I think, a national landslide.
A national landslide. And yet, even though that's going to be the banner race for the evening, I think there's also a lot of talk about how many U.S. House seats Democrats might pick up, Karen. How much attention is being focused on the potential in Texas right now?
A lot. I mean, Texas is really the epicenter. And when you think about it, 11 months ago, as the House was getting ready to impeach Donald Trump, the Republicans were predicting that this was going to cost them the Democrats their majority. And it's really interesting that you don't even hear people talking about impeachment anymore. Nancy Pelosi has built a very disciplined strategy for not only hanging on to her majority, but also expanding it. And I think that Texas is really where, you know, potentially this could happen.
Evan, back in 2018, Democrats gained, 12 seats in the House? And I believe they are 9 away from a majority in the Texas House. You see the Texas House possibly flipping as a result of the count tonight?
I think there's a better chance that the Texas House flips than Joe Biden wins Texas. And I actually think that as much as at the beginning of the year, I was, you know, bearish on the idea that the Democrats could win the Texas House. And then especially during a pandemic where opportunities to knock on doors and organize and all that available to challengers were pretty much down to nil. I think that the political environment nationally, and I think the extraordinary turnout this early vote period, you know, Texas blew through its all-time total turnout record just during the early vote, I give the Democrats a 50% or slightly better than 50% chance of winning back control of the House. And of course, it's critical at all times, but especially heading into a redistricting cycle. That would be a huge coup for the Democrats to pull this off. And again, go back 2 years ago, David, if we were having this conversation on Election Day of 2018 before the results came in, Republicans had a 95-55 advantage over Democrats in the Texas House. It did not seem plausible that over 2 years' time, Democrats would be in a position to take the House back. But they're within range. And as I said, I think there's probably an even chance and maybe a slightly better chance that they take it back this time. And that's extraordinary.
And,
you know,
and
it
really
strikes
that,
me. I'm sorry,
you know,
go ahead. Gary.
I think in some ways that has longer term implications for Texas having a path to blue. It would be flipping the Texas House even more so probably than pulling off a Biden win down in Texas.
So what do you think has changed? Is it because of the Trump effect, or are we talking about the demographics changing? I think basically Texas has gained new residents equivalent to something like two small states since 2016, if I'm not mistaken.
David, I think the answer to those questions is yes, 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 yes. It's everything. I think a number of things have happened. I think in some order, the people responsible this cycle for Texas turning blue are Donald Trump, Beto O'Rourke, Lena Hidalgo, and Chris Hollins. The latter two, people may not know, are the Harris County judge and the Harris County elections administrator, respectively. I think demographic change has been enormous. I think the growth in the population has been enormous. I mean, I really think that it's a perfect storm in some respects for Republicans this cycle. And if they end up keeping control of the majority of the House, it's going to be a surprise when you consider everything that the Democrats were able to throw at them and that conditions on the ground threw at them.
You know, you mentioned Lena Hidalgo, and a lot of people see in her, she's the Harris County judge, as a sort of a new generation of Texas politician. And she specifically invited Joe Biden to come down to Texas, do more campaigning here, and take advantage of the changing political landscape. Karen, what is your best estimate as to why the Biden camp chose not to fight for those 38 electoral votes harder than it did?
Because the Biden campaign, and I think that if he wins tonight, they should be given a lot of credit for this. They have had a theory of how they were going to win, and they have been very, very disciplined in keeping to that theory and making sure, you know, it's primarily based in the upper Midwest. And they weren't distracted. They weren't, as Hillary Clinton's campaign at the end 4 years ago was being drawn into Arizona and places like that, the Biden people have really stuck with the states they need to get to 270.
I think the conventional wisdom tonight is that as those early tallies come in, given the way that votes are counted in most counties in Texas, that we're going to see a lot of red early on and then a lot of blue, given early voting setting new records here in the Lone Star State. How do you see the night playing out, Evan?
I really don't know. I remember that on election night of 2018, when the early vote came in, we saw that Tarrant County, a bellwether, maybe the most important bellwether in the state, in the U.S. Senate race between Ted Cruz and Beto O'Rourke was nearly tied. And we all at the Tribune thought to ourselves, this is going to be an interesting night. Actually, Beto O'Rourke won the election day vote and slightly beat Ted Cruz in Tarrant County. To benchmark the importance of that, David, no Democratic candidate for president has won Tarrant County back to 1952, except for LBJ in 64. Beto O'Rourke did something that Obama didn't do twice, that Clinton didn't do, and that is win Tarrant County. So I think we're going to see in the urban counties votes correctly, kind of a blue mirage, as the popular phrase of the day goes. But I think that some of the rural counties may come in later. I actually think that the inverse is going to be true. I think we're going to see Democrats do well early. I think you're going to see Republican vote come in a little bit later. But here's the thing. The numbers, the sheer numbers, upend any conventional wisdom about how this is going to go. If we end up at 12 million turnout, which is possible, depending upon how big the election day vote is today, I mean, that is 33% more than our best ever turnout. And many of those people have no voting history in Texas, no election history, so no way to know who they are, what they are. Obviously, youth turnout is significantly up. Turnout among women in the early vote period was a couple percentage points higher than the electorate as a whole. There's so much we don't know, David. So I have no idea how to predict it.
Evan Smith, CEO and co-founder of the Texas Tribune. Karen Tumulty, political columnist for the Washington Post and San Antonio native. Thanks to you both. We certainly do appreciate it.
Great to be here.
Thanks, David.
And with the talk of Texas on this election day, social media editor Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. Yes, as we heard, lots of anxiety out there on this election night ahead of the results coming in. Via Facebook, Monica Lee says, I'm sad that businesses have to board up in fear of what may happen in the days to come. We're seeing some of that here in downtown Austin. And similarly, via Twitter, Replay My Reply says, downtown San Antonio businesses have reinforced their property. We're obviously prepping for something big, potentially. And I think, speaking for several people, via Facebook, Rosemary Laguna says, let's get it over with. That's just some of the reactions. We have lots more coming in, and I'll be back with those later in the program.
Yeah, actually, we have quite a ways to go before it's all over, and if you have not cast that ballot yet, well, you know what to do. Let us hear about your experience. Just look for Texas Standard on social media. Wells Dunbar is looking for you and your comments. He'll be back in 35 with more of the Talk of Texas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a statewide network that has been caring for Texans for more than 30 years. More than 55 physicians in the Austin area treat 26,000 cancer patients each year. More at texasoncology.com.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town. Tours with social distancing at Moody Mansion, Bryan Museum, and Bishop's Palace. More at galveston.com. It's Island Time with safety in mind.
Support comes from Austin Water's WaterWise Landscape and Rainscape programs for customers replacing water-thirsty lawns with drought-tolerant native plants. Applications and program information at austinwater.org.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The flurry of activity on Election Day is quickly followed by election night, of course. That anxious ritual often spent glued to one's TV, radio, or smartphone, sometimes with a side of popcorn. But behind the scenes, the day will be far from over. What happens with your votes in Texas, and how are they being tabulated? KERA's Brett Jaspers has been exploring what counts and how in Texas.
First off, if you still have a mail-in ballot on your kitchen table, your best bet is to drop it off at the county elections department today. Then two important things happen at 7 p.m. tonight.
Any voter who is in line by 7 p.m. is entitled to cast their ballot.
That's Mimi Marziani, president of the Texas Civil Rights Project. So to vote, your deadline to be in line is 7 p.m. The other thing we'll get soon after 7 p.m. is our first hit of election results.
We release early voting, very first thing. That will include whatever mail ballots and in-person early voting ballots have been tabulated. That's released at 7 p.m.
Bruce Sherbet is Collin County Elections Administrator. Election offices in many counties around the state have been busy tabulating since the early voting period ended on Friday. Not every state does that. In Collin County, the data will be in a counting room, all queued up.
Because there are no internet connections in any piece of voting equipment, including in the counting station. They're downloaded onto a media that goes out of the room to another room to upload to the website or to the state.
We should see that upload on individual county websites a bit after 7, and the Secretary of State's website will have it soon after, compiled into statewide totals. But that initial rush will have to sustain us for a while, depending on how late the vote centers are open.
We hope they're late and people are out there voting.
Toni Pippins-Poole is Dallas County Elections Administrator. She says it'll take a few hours, at least, before they start getting Election Day results.
We do have to wait till the judges confirm all of their paperwork, pack up, and bring those results to our regional site centers.
Many counties, including Dallas and Collin, use vote centers, which means people can vote anywhere. While that's convenient for voters, it makes it harder to gauge what percentage of votes are in. Voters at a certain state house district, for example, may have voted at a faraway site. Counting Election Day ballots for all vote centers could stretch into the wee hours of Wednesday morning. After that, Collin County's Bruce Sherbet says there's even more to do.
Election night, when it's 100% counted, those are called unofficial totals. And they're unofficial because you still have ballots that have to be processed.
There are thousands of military and overseas ballots coming in, as well as provisional ballots. Still, the limited group of Texans who can vote by mail, plus the sheer size of the electorate here, means a statewide race would have to be extremely close for these ballots to keep news outlets from calling a winner.
If there's an election that's 20 votes different, then those provisionals and late military overseas ballots, those could make a difference.
That situation's not so far-fetched. Some Texas House races had margins in the low hundreds 2 years ago. The big lesson is it might take a long time for official results, because with a large turnout, vote counting simply takes time. Liz Howard at the Brennan Center for Justice cautions that in the meantime, we could hear some overheated rhetoric from statewide or national candidates.
If a candidate is behind and they are trying to suggest that there's a problem, their goal is going to be to make the entire process look chaotic.
No election is perfect, Howard says, but she has faith in local election officials, professionals with a very specific process for counting all valid votes. I'm Brett Jaspers in Dallas.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Depending on the outcome of the presidential election, the future of a bipartisan housing strategy for people experiencing homelessness could be rolled back. Late last month, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson made a stop in the Texas capital city to reveal a homelessness strategy that would scale back an approach called Housing First. And this is a program that tries to get people who are homeless into permanent housing quickly without barriers such as sobriety or participation in other treatment programs. Cassie Huff is Assistant Dean for Undergraduate Programs and a Clinical Associate Professor at UT Austin's Steve Hicks School of Social Work. She specializes in homeless services and policy and issues around poverty. Professor, thanks for joining us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit more about the Housing First model and how it's being used in Texas communities right now.
So Housing First is based on the idea that people are not able to get themselves to a more stable place, especially if they've experienced chronic homelessness, without having Housing First, and then providing wraparound services around that, like substance misuse treatment, job placement, mental health and behavior services. Housing First is being used by most major cities in Texas.
But of course, the question is, how well is it working? Under the Trump administration, it became at least apparent from a visit from Ben Carson, the HUD secretary, that a proposed HUD rule wouldn't allow cities to keep on with this same approach. Is that right?
So we don't know the exact requirements if this goes into effect, but we know that there has been talk of requiring participants to be sober or to have jobs before they are able to get stable housing. And we know from experience that having those things in place without stable housing is just not realistic. And so the federal administration wanting to cut back on Housing First, which can be pricey, in terms of paying for the services needed to make it effective. It has been shown to be effective in several areas in the United States, most notably Seattle and Massachusetts. Longer range good outcomes for people who are chronically homeless, as well as cuts in cost for emergency services, crisis and mental health treatment, costing to be lower with Housing First long term.
So does it seem to be working in Texas? Why or why not?
It does work in Texas when it's been focused at specific populations. So there's been really good outcomes focused on Housing First for veterans, especially in the Austin area, where housing the veterans population were almost at 100%. It's also worked really well with housing homeless youth. Really, more resources are needed in order to be able to get a better feel for how effective Housing First can be on a larger level than that.
There has been a lot of talk of late, certainly, about the idea that substance abuse is an underlying cause of homelessness. And I think, okay, how much does this approach further stigmatize people who are experiencing homelessness, number one? But number two, fail to deal with the underlying problem of substance abuse for those who are suffering?
Yeah, so I think number one, this, you know, talking about substance misuse and people who are homeless, usually it's within kind of a group of barriers that people who are homeless have. So substance misuse may be one part of a much more complex picture that we're not getting. And the other thing is that it's really difficult to complete successfully any sort of substance misuse program when you're homeless. You really need to have some stability in order for that treatment to be effective. The way I think about this is that we're just going back to this kind of inhumane treatment of people thinking about who's worthy versus unworthy of receiving services and having housing.
Cassie Hoff is Assistant Dean for Undergraduate Programs and Clinical Associate Professor at UT Austin Steve Hicks School of Social Work. Professor Huff, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. For voters planning to cast their ballots on Election Day today, most counties in Texas require people to go to polling places in their designated precincts, but about a third do offer countywide voting. Keith Ingram is with the Texas Secretary of State's office.
For this election, we're going to have 77 counties participate in the countywide polling place program, which means their voters can vote anywhere in the county, even on Election Day. And that those 77 counties include about 80% of the Texas population of voters.
Participating counties include Bexar, Dallas, Harris, Tarrant, and Travis. The polls are open until 7 p.m. Voters in line by then can stay in line to cast their ballot. A number of Texas counties are seeing record-breaking turnout for the November general election. That includes Fort Bend County, where nearly 68% of registered voters, or 327,000 people, voted early. County Judge KP George is urging the remaining 160,000 registered voters in the area to cast their ballots today.
I always say this, and we all know that people died to give us this choice to vote and elect our representative for the future. And that is the essence of our democracy. And I hope each and every one of them, those who are not participated yet will take this seriously.
In Texas as a whole, there are nearly 17 million registered voters. 57% voted early. The Texas Civil Rights Project is suing the Trump administration over its migrant protection protocols policy. TPR's Lauren Terrazas reports on the lawsuit filed last night.
It's the first class action suit challenging MPP's discriminatory practices on the basis of disability. The Texas Civil Rights Project alleges U.S. Customs and Border Protection is violating the Administrative Procedures Act. It accuses the agency of not complying with its own policy of not allowing asylum seekers with known physical or mental health issues to be sent back to Mexico. But the 23 plaintiffs listed in the suit have been forced to wait in Mexico while their asylum cases make their way through U.S. immigration courts. I'm Lauren Terrazas in San Antonio.
A district court in El Paso is set to hear arguments tomorrow against a countywide shutdown for non-essential business. The El Paso Times reports the Texas Attorney General and 10 local restaurant operators are suing to block the two-week order issued by the El Paso County Judge late last month due to surging COVID-19 cases. The lawsuit claims the shutdown violates the governor's orders for reopening businesses. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Secretary of State, providing voters details on which approved forms of photo ID they can take to the polls. More at votetexas.gov or 800-252-VOTE.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. 2 weeks ago, the U.S. Census Bureau stopped counting people for the 2020 census. By its own account, it was almost out of people to count. The Bureau claimed that it had reached 99.9% of U.S. households. But a new lawsuit from local governments and advocacy groups alleges that those numbers may not be entirely legitimate, that they were falsified by the Census Bureau in order to speed up the decennial headcount. Joining us now to tell us more, Mike Schneider, who's been covering this story for the Associated Press. Welcome to the Texas Standard, Mike.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What do the plaintiffs in this case actually claim they were instructed to do in order to, what, falsify census data?
Right. The plaintiffs allege that census takers were under pressure in the last few days of the 2020 headcount to close cases at all costs. And so they claim that they were forced to cut corners and sometimes fudge the numbers. And they say they did this by saying that if they couldn't get any information about a household, they instead said that it was either a dangerous address or that the homeowners didn't want to talk to them, when they really should have just kept trying to reach this household and get the information from the residents of the household.
Just so that we're completely clear, when we're talking about the actual moving up of the deadline, wasn't it something like 2 weeks cut off of the original deadline, something along those lines?
Right. Originally, the deadline was at the end of July. But then because of the pandemic, the Census Bureau switched it to the end of October. But sometime at the end of July, the beginning of August, the Census Bureau decided, no, we're going to end it at the end of September, and we're going to cut off a month of counting. After that happened, this coalition of local governments and advocacy groups sued the Trump administration in an effort to have the census continue through October. A federal judge in California agreed with the plaintiffs, mm-hmm. But then the Trump administration appealed, and the Supreme Court sided with the Trump administration, and that allowed the Census Bureau to end the census on October 15th.
So if indeed the census data is found to be fudged, I mean, what's the motive for that? Why would that in some way benefit the Trump administration?
Well, you know, there are two things. First of all, the rush to close cases, I think it was just pressure from supervisors on the census takers to just get the job done no matter what. The plaintiffs in this lawsuit allege that the count was ended early because the Trump administration or President Trump issued an order that would cut out people in the country illegally when it came to the apportionment count. And the apportionment count are the numbers that are used to decide how many congressional seats and electoral college votes each state gets. The plaintiffs in this case about the census timeline say that the deadline for the count was ended early so that the Trump administration has enough time to crunch the numbers while President Trump is still in power, no matter who wins the election. And the reason for this, they say, is so that the Commerce Department, which oversees the Census Bureau, and the Census Bureau can enforce this order from Trump that would cut out undocumented residents from the apportionment count.
And if you live in a census area where the data was faked or inaccurately represented, that would potentially affect representation, as you were discussing a little bit earlier, possibly federal funds for relief programs, that sort of thing.
Right, because the census determines basically $1.5 trillion in federal funding each year and how that money is distributed. And it also determines which states may gain or may lose the congressional seat. And this is very important for Texas because some projections have Texas gaining anywhere from 2 to 3 seats, and an inaccurate count could cost Texas that third seat.
What kind of relief are the plaintiffs asking for in this lawsuit?
Well, because the count has now ended, they're looking for relief on the numbers crunching side. So right now, the Census Bureau is in the middle of data processing, and that's when they correct for errors, they eliminate duplications, they try to fill the gaps in the information they have from the headcount. Mm-hmm. Their deadline right now for turning that into the president is December 31st. And so the plaintiffs in this lawsuit are hoping that the deadline gets extended to the end of April so that there is more time for the Census Bureau statisticians to crunch this number.
Mike Schneider is covering the 2020 census for the Associated Press. Mike, thanks so much for speaking with us on The Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raiseyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms.
Support comes from Austin Water's WaterWise Landscape and Rainscape programs for customers replacing water-thirsty lawns with drought-tolerant native plants. Applications and program information at austinwater.org.
On this election day, it's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. We'll have more on voting in Texas. But first, we turn to El Paso, where COVID-19 cases continue to soar. Hospitals there are at capacity, and some patients are being airlifted to other cities. And El Paso's county judge has ordered a 2-week shutdown of non-essential services. The situation in El Paso right now is similar to what happened in another border region earlier this year that became a hotspot. KERA's Mallory Falk has been looking into what El Paso might learn from the experience of the Rio Grande Valley.
That sound you're hearing, it's from a hospital in the Rio Grande Valley in July when COVID cases were spiking.
The numbers went from 35 patients. 6 weeks later, we had almost 2,000.
Yvonne Melendez is the top health official in Hidalgo County, which includes McAllen. This summer was rough. He treated people he'd known for years who could no longer breathe on their own, lost colleagues to the virus, and he got sick.
So I was very, very, very scared myself.
At the same time, El Paso wasn't hit nearly as hard. That got Melendez wondering. Both regions are on the border and have similar demographics. He figured maybe El Pasoans have better access to primary care. That would mean fewer untreated underlying conditions that put people at risk. But now El Paso is a hotspot.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining today's virtual press conference.
Late last week, local officials painted a grim picture. County Judge Ricardo Samaniego said if something doesn't change, El Paso will see an unprecedented number of deaths.
When we start thinking of working with the morgues and coming up with places to store these souls, and we start shipping our patients to other communities, I don't know what else would say this is a time to do everything that we can to help the medical profession.
Jacob Cintron, head of University Medical Center, said COVID-19 hospitalizations were the highest they'd ever been.
At some point, logically, we're going to run out of capability.
The various hospitals have added 60 beds, 80 beds. We've added over 100 beds and are looking to add more.
That includes overflow tents set up in hospital parking lots. Hidalgo County Health Authority Yvonne Melendez has been here, and he has advice, first for local leaders. He says it's important to connect early with state and federal agencies that can send in resources, like extra beds for field hospitals and medical personnel.
Be early in engaging them and be early in planning to bring these people in.
Healthcare workers have arrived in El Paso from other parts of the state. Melendez also recommends frontline workers take care of themselves. You'll be fatigued and heartbroken, he says. People you've known for years will perish. During all this, it's important to acknowledge the elephant in the room, anger.
You will get frustrated and you will get angry because people will not follow the social distancing recommendations. And you think to yourself, are the sacrifices that we're making worth this community that's not willing to listen, to heed our advice? Can it be that people still don't believe that this exists? Is it possible that people are still politicizing this?
He says it's important for frontline workers to recognize that anger comes from fear.
And that fear usually is of you dying, your mom dying, your children dying, someone in your community that you're exposing because you're at work so much.
Melendez's last piece of advice isn't for right now when El Paso's in the thick of things, but for later. Once the surge is over, prepare for the next wave of the pandemic by improving the baseline health of the community.
Put money into programs for primary care. Those programs that will help people control their diabetes better, their hypertension better, their obesity better, because those are the comorbidities most associated to death once you get COVID.
It's crucial to improve community health, he says, so people have the best possible chance of surviving whatever comes next. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
Cold, dry air can be a trigger for asthma. The fall months are also the traditional start of flu season, which can make things worse for those already having trouble breathing. So this year, with a coronavirus on top of everything, there's even more worry than usual. Dr. Kavita Patel is an expert in pediatric pulmonary medicine with Texas Children's Specialty Care in Austin. Dr. Patel, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Does having asthma, in fact, make people at higher risk for dangerous symptoms related to the coronavirus?
Yes, the CDC states that children with chronic lung diseases, including moderate to severe asthma, are at a higher risk for severe infection. Some children are actually faring quite well in spite of having asthma, and others have had a more dramatic course. Some children have needed to be hospitalized for a short period of time, and I think that is largely based on the severity potentially of their symptoms and the quality of their asthma control at the time of infection. However, there's still a lot that we don't know about this virus in children and our asthmatics.
Is there a difference? Does there seem to be a difference in the way asthmatic kids respond to, say, the regular flu versus the coronavirus?
I don't think we really know that quite yet. I would say the flu is actually commonly known to cause children to be sick enough to be hospitalized. So in that regard, I think there is a bit of a similarity there. However, I'm not really sure of the statistical similarities, if that makes sense.
Is there an easier way to an easy way to determine whether someone has the regular flu or coronavirus?
That's actually a very good question. So I think this is something that makes many of our pediatricians and other pulmonologists a little nervous this year, is that there's quite a bit of overlap between the flu and COVID-19 in terms of symptoms. Just by looking at an individual, you truly can't tell whether it's influenza or coronavirus.
You have to have further testing, I presume.
Yes. I think diagnostic testing is really the only true way to determine if someone has the flu or coronavirus. While there's a lot of media focus on vaccine development for COVID-19, we should remember that there's already a safe vaccine available for the influenza virus, and getting a flu shot is the best tool that we have right now to protect our children and ourselves from getting the flu.
A lot of people are concerned that that might make somehow respiratory symptoms be inflamed, or especially in the case of a child with asthma. That's not the case.
Not with the inactivated flu virus, the one that you actually get with an injection.
So what extra steps should those with asthma, especially kids, be taking right now to be better prepared for what could be a problem season for the coronavirus?
Really, you want to optimize asthma control. And I think that really starts with a cohesive plan from your pediatrician. So basically using an asthma action plan, which outlines, you know, treatment based on symptoms. Also, if your child has been prescribed long-term medication to improve asthma control, you really should be focused on adhering to the schedule recommended by your physician. Mm-hmm. And it can be difficult for busy families to do that, but really trying to come up with ways to remind yourself when a dose is due. Another thing would be to make sure that your child is using the correct technique to take inhaled medications, because poor technique could result in less medication throughout the lower airways, which is where it's needed the most.
So if you've got those spacers, use them.
And that's right.
Right. And of course, and if you've got those preventative medicines, don't be skimping now.
Yes, exactly.
Dr. Kavita Patel is an expert in pediatric pulmonary medicine with Texas Children's Specialty Care in Austin. Dr. Patel, thanks again for your expertise. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU. Stories of Horned Frog changemakers like Amiso George, who is helping organizations navigate COVID-19 crisis communications, can be found at tcu.edu/teamwork.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're tuned to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Many expect a range of legal issues to emerge and be argued over before we'll know the final outcome of the tally tonight. Lawyers on both sides have been prepping for potential challenges. But even on this election day, some legal challenges remain open. Here to break down what does remain and what we might expect for the days after, Steve Vladeck. He is the Charles Allen Wright Chair in Federal Courts at the University of Texas School of Law. He specializes in constitutional law. Professor Vladeck, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thanks, David. Happy Election Day.
And same to you. So we have a group of Republicans who've brought suits to the Texas Supreme Court and to the federal court in Harris County, trying to argue that 127,000 ballots cast at drive-thru voting sites should be tossed. Where do we stand with this after a federal hearing yesterday?
Yeah, so late last night, we had the federal appeals court refusing to basically disturb the decision that the district judge handed down yesterday. What the judge said yesterday was that these plaintiffs don't have standing, that they're not allowed to bring this lawsuit. But he also said there might be concerns about the use of drive-through voting today, but not for early voting. And so I think the safest thing we can say is that the 127,000 plus early votes in Harris mm-hmm. County using drive-through voting are pretty safe at this point. Harris County already, as you know, has actually made some adjustments. There's only one drive-through site that's open today. It's the Toyota Center. And I think that's with an eye toward preventing challengers from taking this all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Very interesting footnote that was offered by the federal judge in this case, who seemed to say that wasn't sure about the technicality of whether some of these tents that had been erected by Harris County would constitute a building, and so could not in good conscience, I think was the language the judge used, encourage people to go to those locations. Was that the idea?
Yeah, that was the idea. And I think that's why we saw Harris County respond overnight and close 9 of the 10 election day drive-through locations. I think the reason why, according to the Harris County clerk, the 10th location, the Toyota Center, is still open is because the drive-through voting there is in the garage. And, you know, I think no matter how we're going to read the Texas election law, you know, the garage is part of the building. So I think this is sort of, you know, a good result for everybody, where the early voters, their votes are safe, and where, just to avoid even the potential of litigation after today, the Harris County clerk has closed 9 of the 10 day of drive-through sites with plenty of accommodations for folks who are planning to vote there, you know, staff to point them to other locations, nearby locations, et cetera, leaving open the Toyota Center as the one place where I think everyone agrees under Texas's definition that is a polling place.
Help me with this, because it sounds like on the one hand, we are hearing that the 127,000 votes are intact. On the other hand, is the judge raising the specter or the possibility that there could be an ex post facto challenge to the validity of those drive-in ballots because of this question over what constitutes a building under Texas law?
So I think the short answer, David, is probably not, because as Judge Hayden pointed out, there's a difference between what Texas election law says about early voting, where there's not the same requirement of voting in a, quote, building or structure, unquote, and election day itself today, where there is. And so I think, you know, the reality is these cases aren't over. The Republican challengers might still try to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. They might try to renew these claims. But for all intents and purposes, you know, I think these votes, both the ones in early voting and the folks who use the Toyota Center for drive-through voting today, are going to be perfectly safe by the time we're done. There might yet be litigation, David, but I think what Judge Hayden was signaling and what the Harris County clerk has, I think, accomplished by closing the other 9 drive-through sites just for today is, you know, this is the way to avoid any real question, at least here in Texas.
Well, you say there might yet be litigation. Are there other issues that you expect could be litigated?
You know, it's always hard to predict, David. I don't think there are obvious questions that are going to arise here in Texas. I mean, you know, there's the question of ballots that come in tomorrow, since Texas law does allow for the receipt of ballots postmarked by Election Day if they're mailed. I think, you know, the real question is the stuff you can't anticipate, David. Are there going to be day of issues? Are there going to be fights to keep the polls open later? But I think the reality is that Texas is increasingly not going to be ground zero if we do end up with a election, you know, that has a real after-the-fact litigation problem. I think that's going to be more about states like Pennsylvania, Minnesota, North Carolina. The way Judge Hayden ruled yesterday, I think, really does, you know, remove the match from the flame when it comes to the specter of real chaos here in Texas.
Steve Vladeck is the Charles Allen Wright Chair in Federal Courts at the University of Texas School at Law. He specializes in constitutional law. Professor, thanks again for sharing your expertise with us on The Standard.
Thank you.
And you are listening to The Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is our social media editor, monitoring the talk of Texas, and I bet there's a lot of people talking online right now, Wells.
You would be correct, David. You know, as I noted earlier, lots of anxiety, some trepidation about voting, what is going to happen today, are things going to shake out results-wise tonight. Lots of excitement, too. Jane Reed Girardi via Twitter. She says that I'm a displaced Texan living in Italy who's streaming The Standard. Right.
Wow.
She says she voted early by mail, so obviously not a little more involved than making it down there to the polling place for some folks. Some folks are, however, one free human. They tweet us that they're reporting live from Richardson, Texas, where the line was empty. No wait. I guess Richardson voted early. And it will be interesting to see what those election day totals do look like, what with this historic surge we've seen in early voting across Texas. Mm-hmm. So it will be interesting to see if those numbers do appear lower. Just anecdotally, looking at some reporters from across Texas out there at the polling places on election days, not saying a whole lot of, you know, lines winding around the block. Some places with no waits, some places with small waits. So it's going to be interesting to see how that shapes up. Diane Treeter, speaking about the races that she's watching that don't include those marquee races like the president and senator, echoing some of what we just heard. Diane says she's watching the Texas House races and says if Democrats win, then that will be the end of Republican gerrymandering there at the legislature. And as y'all were talking, yeah, that would be a heck of a thing and some really, fortunate timing should Democrats take control of the Texas House, what going into a redistricting session with that new census data here, David.
Yeah. David Goodman, reporter for The New York Times, just filed a piece on what I think in a way illustrates just how much Texas and the fact that its political future is hanging in the balance is in the spotlight on the national scale. Some beautiful prose here. He writes, "By the time the sun rose over Collin County on Election Day, 69% of registered voters had already cast a ballot either in person or by mail, the highest percentage in Texas. The huge early turnout underscored the degree to which this traditionally conservative county north of Dallas has fast become a battleground for the political future of the state." David Goodman writing in the New York Times about a county in Texas that symbolizes the fight for the political future of the state. Wells, I know that you're going to be part of our coverage tonight. NPR coverage begins at 6 Central, 5 Mountain Time, and the Texas Standard will have special election coverage starting at 7, and we will have ongoing coverage from our partners across the Lone Star State. We certainly hope you will join us. We won't be doing any predictions or anything like that, just the facts. I'm David Brown, along with the rest of the Texas Standard team, wishing you a terrific election day.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.
Thanks so much for listening to the Texas Standard. KUT and the Texas Standard are members of the NPR network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm David Brown. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support comes from Austin Water's WaterWise Landscape and Rainscape programs for customers replacing water-thirsty lawns with drought-tolerant native plants. Applications and program information at austinwater.org.